from WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. When the curtain closes on the voting booth, there are issues to consider and records and promises. And then, for most voters, there is a choice between two men, George Bush and John Kerry. In the final days of the campaign, we'll look at the inner workings and inclinations of each candidate. What makes him tick? We start tonight with President Bush and examine his famously faith-based presidency. This hour on Point, George Bush, his faith, and the American presidency. But first, in Jerusalem, Israel's parliament today wrapped up 2 days of bitter debate and voted 67 to 45 to back Prime Minister Ariel Sharon's plan to uproot Israeli settlers in the Gaza Strip. The vote came after months of angry confrontation between Sharon and many in his own Likud party. Harvey Morris is Jerusalem bureau chief for the Financial Times. I asked him how high passions were running over today's vote.
Passions, I suppose, in the political establishment and among the settlers were certainly running high. I'm not sure they were running terribly high among the public, who really, for the most part, two out of three of them, according to the opinion polls, just want this thing over and done with. So although it's been billed as very dramatic and very historic, for ordinary Israelis, it's failed to reach the sort of emotional peaks that some of the previous decisions of the past have engendered.
What do opinion polls show about general Israeli views on pulling out of Gaza?
Well, they've been very consistent, I would say, over the past 12 months, that a constant two-thirds of Israelis say, yes, let's get this Gaza evacuation underway. Obviously, there's a slight distinction depending on which party people generally vote for. I mean, it's more of a left-wing cause than it is a right-wing one. Nevertheless, you know, this two out of three ratio seems to persist.
And Harvey, can you describe for us the alliance of votes that Ariel Sharon put together to win his 67-45 against victory today?
Well, he got slightly over half of the members of his own Likud party, which, you know, is going to spell trouble in the future as far as that party is concerned. If he'd just been relying on Likud, which is the biggest party in the parliament, then he wouldn't have got it through. But he had the support of the Labour Party and some other left-wing parties, and that gave him a fairly comfortable result of 67 out of 120. However, some of the Likud ministers in his coalition, although they quite reluctantly voted in his favor, have said that they're prepared to quit the government in 2 weeks' time unless he holds a national referendum on this issue.
And what exactly does today's vote commit Israel to doing, Harvey?
Well, what it does is to commit the Parliament to agreeing in principle to the idea of evacuating settlements in Gaza and a very small number in the West Bank. The actual vote for carrying out such evacuations will be taken by the Cabinet, and those votes may not take place until next March. Now, that is because of a deal that was done between Ariel Sharon earlier this year and some of his more reluctant colleagues in the cabinet that they should have the final say on actually saying, right, okay, let's get out next week. Now, it's those very people who are now insisting that there be a referendum before anything further can happen.
We're talking about more than 8,000 settlers to come out of Gaza, where, what, more than a million Palestinians live.
Yeah, that's right. Well, the numbers vary. I would estimate it's probably 7,000 in Gaza and maybe a few hundred, up to 1,000 in the West Bank. Mm-hmm. And in Gaza, yes, you're quite right, 1.3 million Palestinians live there.
Ariel Sharon has long been considered sort of the father of Israeli settlements. Why did he come to this decision to turn around and push for withdrawal from Gaza?
Well, what he said was in his speech opening this debate yesterday was that he thinks that this is the best way to ensure Israel's security. Now, what he said was that to withdraw from Gaza will ensure that Israel can control those areas which it sees as vital to its future, from which one must deduce he means areas of the West Bank, which the Palestinians regard as theirs. And that's always been the fear, certainly among the Palestinians, about this plan, that, okay, they get Gaza back, but he hangs on to the West Bank.
We're seeing settlers today calling this a kind of treason. What's the vision that among settlers that's so offended by the move the Knesset's taken today?
Well, the settlers are a bit of a mixture. They proclaim themselves to be deeply Zionist, but they do have a very much a religious outlook. And they say very simply that the Bible states that the land of Israel was given to the Jews, and full stop, end of story. So they're not particularly amenable to pragmatic political arguments of the kind that Mr. Sharon has put to them.
16 bodyguards around the Prime Minister when he came to the Knesset today, we read. Extraordinary concern over his personal security.
Yeah, there is, and of course it's quite ironic that today, according to the Jewish calendar, is the anniversary, ninth anniversary of Yitzhak Rabin's assassination. And he also was, he was assassinated by a Jewish extremist who, again, was against the whole idea of handing over what the religious regard as the land of Israel. I think a lot of the talk of threats against Mr. Sharon have been somewhat played up by the government because, it makes his position look much more heroic than it already is. So I think there's an element of propaganda there, but certainly there are genuine concerns for his safety.
And how are Palestinians responding to this move toward an Israeli withdrawal from Gaza? Are they seeing it as a step toward a solution, toward two states, or something else?
I don't think many people are saying this is a step towards a solution, a two-state solution. What some are saying is, look, we can't very well say to Israel, don't withdraw from our territory, given that that's the very thing we've been fighting for the last 4 years. But they're not happy with the plan. They're not happy with it because they think that this will allow Israel to consolidate its hold on quite substantial areas of the West Bank.
Harvey Morris, thanks very much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Harvey Morris is Jerusalem Bureau Chief for the Financial Times. He spoke with us from Jerusalem. Presidential politics and religion may never have been closer than they've been in the Bush White House. In the Arizona debate with John Kerry, President Bush talked about the importance of faith in his life.
Prayer and religion sustain me. I receive calmness in the storms of the presidency. I love the fact that people pray for me and my family all around the country. Somebody asked me one time, well, how do you know? I said, I just feel it.
George W. Bush has made religious faith central to his presidency in a way that strikes many as new. His very public faith delights many Americans and troubles many Americans. Whatever your perspective, it is clearly core to his decision-making and to his style of leadership. In a provocative New York Times Magazine cover story titled Faith, Certainty, and the Presidency of George W. Bush, author and journalist Ron Suskind describes the president as a leader of faith who demands unquestioning faith from his followers, his staff, his senior aides. The race for the White House is neck and neck. How voters respond to a candidate who looks first to Jesus for guidance could make the difference. This hour, On Point, the faith-based presidency of President George W. Bush. You can join the conversation. How deeply do you see religious faith running in the Bush White House? Is faith at the heart of this man, this presidency? And does Bush's religious faith draw your vote or repel it? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Washington is author and journalist Ron Suskind. He wrote the recent New York Times Magazine cover story, Faith, Certainty in the Presidency of George W. Bush. From 1993 to 2000, he was senior national affairs reporter for the Wall Street Journal. His most recent book is The Price of Loyalty, George W. Bush, the White House, and the Education of Paul O'Neill. Ron Suskind, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom. Hello to our guest.
Hi, Jack. How are you?
Good, thank you.
Ron, we all, I expect, feel as though we know something about the faith of George Bush. He talks about being private about it, but at the same time, it is very, very public. You came in here on a kind of mission, it appears to me, to do a deep reading of that faith and its impact on the presidency. But let's look at the faith itself first. How would you describe this president's faith? How does it compare, if you've paid attention, to the style of faith, the depth of faith other presidents have brought to the White House?
It's clearly important to establish context, Tom. We've had many presidents. I think we could say most presidents have been men of faith. And at this point, I think to make the conversation so clear as to what's different, that's what we're looking for, mm-hmm. is to look at what other presidents have done. Abraham Lincoln, I think, is probably one might conjecture the president who dealt most elegantly with the complications of faith and public life. You know, the founders suffering and remembering the punitive pieties of state religions in Europe. We're very clear about building a wall between organized religion and political authority. And Lincoln, I think, handles it with real majesty, which others have copied, where even after the Civil War, when the country was just battered and bleeding, he says in, I think people would argue, his greatest speech, one of the greatest in American history, the second inaugural address, he says, essentially, both sides are praying to the same God. For triumph for their own righteousness, and neither side's prayers will be answered, certainly not fully. And Lincoln says, as he essentially summons God from God's sort of balcony at the theater, he does it to say we cannot know God's will, and all we may know is simply this message which Lincoln offers at the end of the speech: with malice toward none, with charity for all, with goodness and the right as God gives us to see the right, let us bind the nation's wounds. George Bush does it very differently, and there's no doubt about that. There's an interesting passage in the story in the Times that I wrote, which I think, you know, hits it right in the head. Mm. George Bush has been doing these Ask President Bush meetings around the country.
Right.
And one of them, I think, was illuminating. It was in Florida, and someone stood up. These are very carefully choreographed events. You know, the folks there are vetted, and people mm-hmm. sort of stand mm-hmm. and ask them questions that, you know, are not particularly challenging. And someone said, you know, Mr. President, I've been a Republican my whole life, but this is the first time I feel that God is in the White House. Now, most presidents would say, now, hold on a minute. A man is in the White House, and we cannot know God's will. That's part of the American ideal of how to handle faith. This president, George Bush, simply says thank you. And the room rises into thunderous applause. This is the way George Bush has handled faith. Lincoln Chafee, the senator from Rhode Island, I think, said it very artfully again in the Times piece when we chatted about this. And he's quite troubled about the way faith has entered the dialogue, and also what he feels is the radical turn in foreign affairs to a sort of messianic, rid the world of evil concept, sweeping and, extreme, in his opinion. You know, he said the key to this election will be George Bush's desire to signal to the core of his base, the evangelical Christians, and there's an enormous community of them. 42% of Americans identify themselves as either born again or evangelical.
A huge number.
It is a huge number. It's not so dramatic or visible on the coastlines, but if you go into the big wide center, you'll find it more. And Chafee says the key is for Bush to signal to them that he is a messenger of God, which they do believe, but do it in a way that's artful enough that he doesn't confuse or trouble those in the swing states who may not be quite so ardent.
We're looking into
that's quite a message.
Tonight. Ron Suskind, we've got to take a short break here. Jack Beatty will be right back. We're talking tonight with Ron Suskind about the faith-based presidency of George W. Bush, trying to get really up close with this man, with this leader. How deeply do you see religious faith running in the Bush White House? is faith at the heart of this man, this presidency, and what has that meant for American policy under George Bush? Does George Bush's religious faith draw your vote or repel it? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about George Bush, the candidate, the president, the man, and the religious faith that appears to drive his presidency. Our guest tonight is Ron Suskind, author and journalist, author of The Price of Loyalty, the book about Paul O'Neill's experience in the Bush administration. He had a recent article in New York Times Magazine, Faith, Certainty, and the Presidency of George W. Bush. You can join this conversation tonight. What do George Bush and his faith represent in American culture today, in American hopes and American fears? And what does it mean to vote for a president because of his faith? Will you do that next week? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Jack Beatty, Ron's got a lot more reporting. We want to get into it here, but I want to get your just an opening take, if you'd share it with us. As we try and look, a lot of people will be thinking about who is this man if they haven't already made up their minds when they enter the voting booth next week. And you just can't escape faith when you think about George Bush.
Yeah, but, you know, you can't escape its political uses either. We don't know his heart. We just don't know. I mean, he says he speaks to Jesus. I expect that he's had some religious experience. But the fact is that he has positioned himself right at the head of the major social political movement of our time. That is fundamentalism, the protest against the valueless void of modern capitalism, of sexual changes, of the rise of women, all of that. Mm-hmm. And that is the most, unquestionably, the most powerful movement of our time. And here along comes George Bush, even before Karl Rove, even before the political genius. And he sees what the religious right does to his father in Iowa. Pat Robinson gets that vote, beats George H.W. Bush right. In 1988 there. And young Bush sees that this is the coming power, and that he sees that Jimmy Carter was elected largely with this vote, that it switched to Reagan, and that the Republican Party, the whole character of it, was changing. And he positions himself right at the head of that group. And how does he do it? Just by talking about Jesus, just by saying that his heart is commanded by Jesus. And just by pretty much going at life as if that's all you need to know. That's all he needs to be as a president. He has no intellectual curiosity, but he has a very shrewd political intelligence that has placed him right at the center of this big, big movement.
Ron Suskind, how about that? We're hearing a big note of skepticism there from Jack Beatty. Maybe this is all to a political end. Of course, it doesn't have to be that deliberate for it to work to a political end. And George Bush, we've all read the account of his midlife conversion, his sort of come-to-Jesus moment. How do you read the sincerity and the political uses of his faith?
Well, you know, I like what Jack says. I essentially say something similar in the story. You know, you can't know George Bush's heart. Part of what I've tried to do over the last 3 years is to know this man. You know, he's been both the most forceful and opaque leader of modern times. I mean, no doubt about it. You know, he's managed to remain virtually invisible in plain sight. And there's no doubt, as Jack says, that he has harnessed. He's like juggling fuel rods here. He has harnessed this extraordinary power, this growing inclination of American society. Frankly, it's happening around the world toward fundamentalism, toward evangelical, charismatic, ardent religion. The fact is, what I say in the story is that what's happening here in America, certainly it's happening in the Islamic world, a battle between modernists and fundamentalists, between reason and religion, between the faith-based community and what I call, I cite a White House person who, an administration person in a quote, now people have picked it up, the reality-based community. There's no doubt he's using it with incredible artfulness. I mean, in the political dialogue, that's what Bush is doing. And you know, what's interesting, I mean, because, you know, we all turn to faith when we face imponderables in our lives, you know, a personal tragedy or a challenge. I mean, that's traditional. What I found in studying George Bush over years and speaking in an unmanaged way, I think that's an important point, to many people who have spent a lot of time with Bush. That's mm-hmm. the one thing that I've been able to do, some of it just by dumb luck, over the last 3 years. So I have people who are spending time with him up close. And And more they're saying the same thing to me. You know, when they would ask Bush, please explain to me why you're doing what you're doing. I'm a cabinet-level official. I just want to sell your policy. The president would often say, man, I go with my gut, I go on instinct, and I pray over it. Increasingly, as Bruce Bartlett says in the lead of the story, and he served Ronald Reagan and he served the first President Bush, he says, increasingly, people up close to Bush are understanding that this is a sort of messianic view of what he thinks God told him to do. Now, whether that's true or not, I think remains, at least in some measure, a mystery. It's clear, though, that that's what he's projecting to enormous effect. You know, one of the things that's fascinating is there are two sides of it, which I think Jack is alluding to as well in terms of the president's curiosity or lack thereof, which I have obviously documented over time. The president's just retreat from the basic critical analytical faculties that most presidents have relied on. There's no mistaking that.
What's the evidence of that, Ron?
Oh, my goodness gracious. You know, I mean, I can't tell you how many people I've talked to about it. It's not just Paul O'Neill or John DiIulio, who headed the faith-based program. He's the first person to come out and speak to me in an unmanaged way, and obviously he faced extraordinary consequences.
And when you say unmanaged, you mean not overseen by White House handlers?
Exactly. Not part of, you know, here you'll have access to this person. Thank you very much.
Right.
And no, I basically, at the start of 2002, got into the White House. I was doing a profile of Karen Hughes. You know, it was a time of great hubris in the building. The president had about a 90% approval rating. You know, people, they were looking for a Boswell. There I was. I was profiling Karen Hughes, and obviously all such profiles are really about the president. That's who you care about. You know, I even had a desk in the West Wing. They didn't like the story, but the story was so noisy because people actually got a glimpse in the building to how much the president delegates basic presidential duties to other people, how he retreats from just the standards of empiricism. You know, a historian I was talking to recently said, what do we elect presidents for? Generally, to get the shade of gray just right. That's what they're there for. And this president, time and again, has simply said, you know, I'm not going to do those basic things. You know, it's interesting because as it has evolved through DiIulio and then Paul O'Neill and the many people who have actually come forward, often off the record or not for attribution, but some on the record, to say, look, he's not reading memos, even one-pagers. You know, there's some sense that he didn't even read the August 6th memo of 2001, the famous one that warned of bin Laden. He didn't read the one-page memo about weapons of mass destruction. You know, I think that people have
and he
have
didn't
lost
read it
their
because bearings. Because you're being told he has the sense he doesn't need to, that his gut plus prayer, that is faith, is sufficient.
Either he doesn't want to, and then turns to prayer and considers these issues part of the imponderables. That he will look deep within his soul to figure out the answers to. You know, he does read the Bible for about an hour each morning, but I think that's most of his reading. You know, he does talk to people. There's lots of, you know, kind of tell me what you think. I think emblematic of that is the famous encounter with George Tenet on weapons of mass destruction. You know, I think that shows, Tom, how we've lost our bearings a bit as to what's normative, what's conventional. Like, here is an issue which is right at the center of our justification for war. Now, most presidents, you know, they sweat the details. They're up late at night. They're calling in competing advisors. You know, they're losing sleep for good reason. Here's a case where the president essentially calls in George Tenet and says to him, you know, I've heard a lot about weapons of mass destruction. Is this all we have? Tenet says it's a slam dunk. The president asks again, and he says, yeah, this case is a slam dunk. Most presidents, just that wouldn't be nearly enough to just turn to the CIA director and say, do you have confidence? Thereby, I will have confidence. But that's right at the key of this issue of confidence and faith for this president.
Is there a distinction to be drawn there, Ron Suskind, between the president's obvious kind of what comes off as confidence, great confidence in himself, and faith? Are they one and the same? Are they different?
Well, there's clearly a joining. You know, he feels that he is carrying forward a divine plan. I don't think there's any doubt about that. And he feels that he is being guided in this plan by, you know, a kind of a mystical power He shows that in countless ways, especially to senior advisors. Those are my sources. That's who I'm interested in, people who get to see him, who have that little Herodotus perch where they can see him both in detail and context. And, you know, essentially they'll say time and again, he's got this extraordinary preternatural faith. And I'm not sure of its source, the confidence, rather, and I think it's from faith. Even a fascinating interchange just came out a few days ago from Pat Robertson, where Robertson says, you know, he meets with the president before Iraq, which is clearly the moment where the president sort of moves into the terrain where there's so many doubters that he's kept out of the circle. The circle around this president is tighter than any of modern times. Republicans tell me that. It's not Democrats. You know, it's a bubble. It's an echo chamber of his own making. The president has said as much to Bob Woodward. Here's Robertson talking to the president prior to Iraq, and Robertson's concerned, and he says to the president, look, there's going to be casualties. You need to prepare the country for that. And Bush turns to Robertson and says, you know, we're not going to have any casualties. Robertson is stunned. He says, I've never seen a man so confident, you know, so suffused with a kind of a triumphal perspicacity. I don't think that's his exact word, but all but. Mm. And you know, here's a faith healer who is stunned, Pat Robertson.
And are you confident in these quotes that come from Mr. Robertson there? Or that the Amish meeting where the president, you quote him being quoted by the Amish in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, saying, what words to the effect that I'm guided by God or something like that. Are you getting this right? Or are these being somehow boiled down, reduced, made more bold by the audience?
Certainly Robertson is first off, Robertson, you know, he's a grown up and he says this is what the president said. I remember it rather distinctly. The White House does what it does with everybody. He says, no, the president never said that. And Pat Robertson's got it wrong or he lied or whatever. Robertson says, I didn't. That's kind of the way it works unless there's some written or transcribed text. Interestingly, though, for instrument of God quotes like with the Amish, those pop up every few months. The White House actually doesn't stridently deny them. They just say the president didn't say that, but he does rely on faith. It's always sort of a nod and wink. He might have said that, but, you know, we won't confirm that. Mm. But yes, he does turn to God. And that's part of this signaling system. This is so crucial in this election. You know, I've talked over the last few months to so many people in the faith-based core. They are absolutely unfettered and without hesitation. They say this man is a messenger of God. They're quoted in my story, brought here to guide America at a time of peril, to see evil here and abroad, to protect the nation. He is God's messenger. That's what they feel. It is not the traditional dialogue of informed consent in an age of reason, enlightenment principles that we're used to in the country. It is a writ of infallibility. And that writ of infallibility is not just for public consumption, Tom. It's not just out there in the hustings. It is also what has defined life in the innermost circles of the White House. You know,
Hold that thought. I want to hear more about that, but a lot of callers want to join us as well. Jack Beatty, please stand by. Let's begin to turn to our listeners. Barbara is calling from Raleigh, North Carolina. Hi, Barbara. You're on the air.
Thank you so much. Yeah. I want to say how much I appreciate this program and to share with you how terrifying George Bush is for me as I experience his version of faith in God.
Mine Why? Why, Barbara?
Different. My version of God and of Jesus, the things that he said is of love and peace and looking out for the least of these. It is not about warmongering and profiteering and pushing an agenda using a very powerful tool. For example, I understand way back Roman times, Constantine was able to subjugate the people by adopting faith, you know, pushing that through the Roman Empire. I sort of feel like that's what's happening here. Instead of taking the words that Jesus actually said, the principles that we're actually called to live, George Bush is taking sound bites and driving through our country the exact opposite of what we are called to do as Christians.
But, Barbara, you know, many conservative religious leaders, Christian, Jewish as well, are thrilled with this president.
Well, I suppose that's because that agrees with whatever their political agenda is. Religion can be molded, I suppose, in the public discourse to fit fit one's will, but if you really go back to what Jesus said and, you know, how we are to live, it is the opposite of what George Bush is doing. And I'd like to say real quickly that he is a Methodist, and we have social principles, and he has completely turned his back on the Methodist social principles and has time and time again refused to talk with Methodist leaders who tried to caution him against entering into this war.
Barbara, thanks very much for your call. Runciskan, what about George Bush's conversation with the world of faith? Barbara says he's not talking with Methodist leaders, though he's a Methodist. Who does George Bush talk with about faith?
Well, you know, there are many faith-based advisors who have extraordinary access, as they've all said, to the White House. You know, Franklin Graham, who, you know, called Islam an evil religion. The Jerry Falwell, Pat Robertson community. There's a community of advisors who are from the Christian right or the evangelical right, who, you know, the president communes with and turns to. And I think Barbara's point is an interesting one because, you know, as Jim Wallis, who's the head of the Sojourners, who is clearly a progressive liberal evangelical, says in the piece, he said, you know, there are many flavors of faith, and how faith shines through the prism of human vanity and frailty. That's what makes it so complex. It can be used for so many purposes, often other than godly purposes. And, you know, and clearly, as we all know from religion over X number of centuries, you know, millennia really, you know, there's the side of judgment, you know, and there's also the side of kind of humble healing. You know, the founders, I think we're very clear, and many of them wrote about this, they are comfortable with the notion of ministry, of outreach to the poor, to the disenfranchised, to the desperate. But they fear judgment. You know, clearly over the past several millennia, you know, many people have been slaughtered by virtue of a blind or overweening confidence in judgment, in the notion of some right and others evil or wrong.
Jack, that's what
scares people like Barbara.
Yeah, Jack, we hear Ron Suskind's view of George Bush's faith and our caller Barbara's response to it, and yet this is striking a chord with millions and millions of Americans.
Well, yes. I mean, he lives by his faith. He goes at life that way. And I think the very fact that he sometimes seems so intellectually pathetic is really something that appeals to people who, in effect, in their private lives, they're not that way. But they go at life fundamentally without intellect, because intellect isn't going to get them to salvation. But, you know, I think Bush, what I'm struck with is the moral consequences of his faith. It seems to me he shows in an extreme degree what the Puritans saw as one of their great temptations, that is antinomianism, the belief that to the saved anything is permitted. A man who can say there's going to be no casualties in a war isn't thinking morally about the human flesh that is going to be destroyed in that war. That isn't even part of his outlook. It's not, the moral question doesn't even arise to him.
Maybe that's a shorthand, though, for hey, this is going to be a cakewalk. My advisors tell me we're going to go in and do it quick.
Well, I don't know. I found it pretty scary.
Can be that. Jack Beatty, Ron Suskind, stand by. We're talking tonight about the faith-based presidency of George W. Bush. You can join this conversation. What do you see driving the core of this presidency? Is it the hand of God? Do you see the fingerprints of faith in George Bush's record as president? And then there's this, is a victory for Bush a victory for God? What does that mean? We're at 1-800-423-8255. It's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the faith-based presidency of George W. Bush. Our guest is Ron Suskind. He's a author of The Price of Loyalty, George W. Bush, The White House, and the Education of Paul O'Neill, about the Secretary of the Treasury who left the Bush administration. He wrote a New York Times piece called Faith, Certainty, and the Presidency of George W. Bush, delving into how President Bush's faith has played out throughout the 4 years of his first term. You can join our conversation tonight. What do George Bush and his faith represent in American culture today, in American hopes, in American fears? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Francesca, I've got to ask you, you quote Mark McKinnon in your piece, longtime top-level media advisor to George Bush. You're talking with him about George Bush's faith, and as I read it here, he turns to you, and he says to you, you think he's an idiot, don't you? And then he says, let me clue you in, we don't care. You see, you're outnumbered 2-1 by folks in the big, wide middle of America, busy working people. They have faith in him. That is to say, whatever you may think of him, however you may analyze him, it doesn't matter. This man is in tune with that big, wide middle of America, as McKinnon put it.
Yeah, you know, and I think it's important, Tom, to look clearly at the extraordinary appeal of what George Bush has done and what he's harnessed here. You know, I mean, there's so much that he's tapped into of you know, the America at this moment. He's both captive and creator, I think, of this moment. But, you know, out there, if the faith-based folks that I speak with, they say, look, first off, who can know what needs to be known? You know, we live in a culture of assertion rather than authenticity increasingly. There are no empirically sound agreed upon facts. You know, there's perception and increasingly faith. You know, faith what? We have but faith we cannot know, for knowledge is of things we see. I can't believe what I see. You know, increasingly the sort of honest broker mainstream media has been discounted and I think compromised by attacks. You know, and look, in like a previous book I wrote, A Hope in the Unseen, that was all about the transforming power of faith. Faith is a hope in the unseen. And there is this exhaustion from trying to wrestle with these, you know, sweeping issues, the tectonic plate shifting. And people say, simply tell us what you think the mission is. You know, Lamar Alexander, the Republican senator from Tennessee, who I interviewed for the story, said something which I thought was insightful. He said, look, we've had these moments of religious revival in America before. He said they tend to happen when we are either very satiated or very afraid. And right now we're both. And as well, those proscriptions from the founders, their fears about political authority and organized religion, you know, boy, that seems like a long time ago. Now as we face an Islamic fundamentalist opponent who is virulent in its extremism, who calls us evil as we call them evil. That's what Bruce Bartlett says at the start of the story, and other people have talked about. And these are old-style Republicans, most of them, like O'Neill. He says, look, this sort of this dance of extremism, where the thing an extremist most needs is another extremist on the other side. You know, I think that there's probably little doubt, if you just think strategically about Al-Qaeda. And, you know, I may get criticized for saying this. It's just my own opinion. But, you know, a social transnational movement like that really relies on a boogeyman, you know, the villain. And George Bush has been such a convenient villain for them. I think that in their hearts, they're probably hoping for reelection. A question is whether they will act to push forward that you know, that strategy in the last week of the election. I think some of the fears that are sort of floating around out there is that, you know, there could be something that happens in the last week, a bombing, something.
Yeah, we should point out that.
And if that were to happen, I think there'd be a rally around George Bush. I think there would be a moment.
But Al-Qaeda's been a no-show, effectively, in the U.S. so far, and George Bush, though it's tight, appears to be leading on his own. Let's get another caller. Andy's calling from Durham, North Carolina. Hi, Andy. You're on the air.
Hello, how you doing?
Just great.
I'm listening to this, and I just think your opinions are pretty preposterous and not reflective of the population as a whole.
How do you see it, Andy?
I see it as that you're afraid of George Bush's religion and the fact that it's actually somewhat out there. It makes you uncomfortable. I think he reflects, most people in the country that have religion, which is about 80%, I think, if not higher. He doesn't wear it as a crusading hat. I think it's just part of him amongst the many other character traits he has. It's just one that you're pointing out and trying to turn him into some religious zealot crusader.
Andy, let me ask you, do you think that the profile of faith is higher in this White House? And if so, why?
I don't think so. I don't think it's any higher than you see Bill Clinton going out to black churches or anybody else. I think it's just another little sort of act by the people that are talking on your show right now to try and sort of vilify this guy who's acting on events that have occurred 10 years before he actually got into office and having to act on that, and then you're trying to make him out as some kind of modern-day crusader.
Is George Bush's faith a comfort to you, Andy?
Pardon?
Is it a comfort to you, George Bush's faith?
Is it a comfort? No, it's a comfort to me to know that he's acting when other people have not acted and cost us 3,000 lives in a building. That's the way I view that.
So good for the man who's acting. Andy, thanks for your call. Ron Suskind, there's the voice, one can imagine, of no small number of Americans saying, wait a minute, this guy's not so out of line. I see in him what I feel or desire in my own life.
I've talked to lots of guys like Andy. I think Andy makes a valid point about George Bush as a man of action, a man who is not encumbered by the common hesitations and reasonable doubts that, frankly, have slowed the hand of other men, including his father and most presidents. I think that's what Andy likes about the president, and understandably. I mean, many people across all the divides seem to like that. We certainly liked it after 9/11. I don't think Andy's right about he's just like Bill Clinton. Clinton comes from another strain, which is, frankly, more of the liberal tradition of ardent faith. You know, going to black churches and, you know, talking about the Spirit guiding his own life, outreach to people not like him, you know, ministering to the poor, you know, a personal search rather than a kind of triumphalism that the president embraces in terms of judgment and good and evil. It's a distinction that many folks, evangelicals on all sides, have pointed at. Many of them evangelicals who support the president. They say, look, we like the fact that this president says there is good and evil, watch out. We will act, and we will vanquish it here or around the world.
Andy comes
I think
back
it's part
to
of
point,
his appeal.
And Andy comes back to your point that in a complicated time, some Americans are taking comfort in a president who, whatever his belief system, it enables him to act vigorously.
Oh, you bet. You know, and that's what the Time story. You know, I don't come down in a kind of a tough judgment on the president. I just say, here are the two sides of this thing. You know, the president clearly has built an extraordinary engine, an electoral engine, and the soul of this new machine, so to speak, are people like Andy, and Andy multiplied times a couple of million, who say, yes, I love the fact that he is so forceful, that he is so directed, that he is so confident. That confidence is something that nourishes them. And it's interesting, it's kind of a transactional conversation, which is fascinating, where essentially the faith-based community that supports the president or likes the way he brings this ardent faith-based certainty into the public realm, they say, look, you know, we pray for him, and he's strengthened by our prayers. The president says as much back.
Mm-hmm.
Some people on the flip side would say it's a codependency. I think actually it's an enormous kind of wellspring he's tapped, and it's giving people comfort at a time of peril.
And yet, one wants to feel that it's a well-considered path that the country has led on, and not just gut, no matter how great the faith. Alice is calling from Medford, Oregon. Hi, Alice. You're on the air.
Yes. Thank you for finally taking my call. Bush turns me off. Absolutely. I wouldn't vote for him. To me, he is not qualified to be president. He's only qualified to be a preacher in a church.
Well, how does his faith come into your assessment of the president, Alice?
Just what I said. He's only qualified to be a preacher in a church. Our founding fathers, Jefferson in particular, you put a wall up, separation of church and state. That's what this country was founded on, and I will never deviate from it. I am 75 years old, and I've voted in a lot of elections. I've never heard talking about religion as this president.
So much around religion. Alice, thanks very much for your call. So, Jack Beatty, here we are. You know, you can hear the callers who say, look, we want a man of action, and if his faith powers that, let's go. And others who say, Alice is 75 and saying, I've never heard this much religion in the White House, and she's just not comfortable with it.
Yes, it makes Bush comfortable with himself. What does he call it? It gives me calm in the storms. But I wonder what Andy, our earlier caller, would say, to go back to a moment where in Ron's piece, where Joe Biden in the White House says to Bush, well, have you looked into this? Are you sure about this? What about this complexity and that complexity? And he said, Joe, I don't need to know about that. I feel it in my gut. This was talking about Iraq. I just feel it in my gut. This is the right. Oh, my gosh, Andy, is that what you want? Surely he should check his gut with his brain.
You know, Jack, it's interesting because Biden, he said this at a meeting of senators. I was a guest speaker with about 40 Democratic senators after the price of loyalty came out, which, by the way, is out in paperback now with some documents in the back. People are liking that. O'Neill gave me 19,000 documents. I put about 10 of the best ones in the back. But interesting, Biden says, you know, when the president says that, Jack, he says, you know, your faith isn't good enough. You know, he essentially says, you know you don't. How can you be so certain when you know you don't know the facts? And it's interesting because I think that's the other side of this that is troubling. I was on the Stephanopoulos show, and George Will and I were sitting next to each other, and Will brought up Woodrow Wilson and says, well, you know, he believed he was on a kind of messianic mission. And yeah, true. First off, some people find that troubling, this sort of save the world, you know, moral arc that I think may have gotten Wilson into some trouble. But Wilson was also, for most of his presidency, especially before he got sick, very reality-based. I mean, he was a man of extraordinary analytical capabilities. That's the thing that troubles Biden and others in the so-called reality-based community. Interestingly, there are, if you go online, there's a bunch of websites, they're producing T-shirts that are selling like hotcakes. Proud member of the reality-based community as opposed to the faith-based community. That's the divide. That if the president... there are people who say the faith they fear is a default for a man overwhelmed. And that's what I track across the almost four years of his presidency, where you find him in 2001, where he increasingly retreats to an ever smaller circle because he can't even show himself in many cases to senior advisors. He just doesn't have mastery over the issues up to a level of competence. And that, you know, part of what I try to do in the piece is show some sympathy. George Bush, look, the fact is he's been sitting at mahogany tables for much of the past 30 years prior to his presidency, you know, not having much to offer. That's not his thing. He's got an improvisational gift. He's extremely interpretive. He's a man of action. He synthesizes quickly and moves.
Very substantial, you know, gifts in all those categories.
Oh, no doubt about it. But it's the other part. It's the throughput. It's the analytical and critical faculties. It's marshaling the government to make sure goals and outcomes match. That he has never been good at. And at some point, it became clear to many advisors that, especially in terms of Iraq, we're not getting close to some of these overarching prescriptions, these sweeping notions of bringing freedom to the planet. Look, we all want world peace. The question is that U.S. policy? Another president, Harry Truman, who was quite religious, says in a speech late in his presidency, he talks about people wanting him to call the communists and then emerging so strongly, evil, evil, evil. He says, I'm not going to do it. You know, the fact is you've got to know your enemy. You've got to look at the limited means and limited goals of U.S. policy. That's the key to what a president needs to do, to be realistic so that we don't get into trouble. And this is Harry Truman. He says, look, don't vilify them. Don't say they're evil, because we're going to have to share the planet with them in this spinning void, this spinning planet in the void for a long time. It's a very different ethos, and it's one that allows for faith, but also allows for a kind of reality-based check. Not just asking for the best case scenarios, but making sure you ask for the worst case scenarios. That's what people fear.
That is a long way from the Bush view, a president who says that he's not prepared to share the planet with terrorists. He's just not going to do it, and his faith is helping him drive that program. Ron Suskind, a fascinating article. Fascinating having you with us tonight. Thanks so much for joining us.
No, my pleasure, Tom.
Ron Suskind, author of The Price of Loyalty. He was senior national affairs reporter for the Wall Street Journal for most of the 90s, journalist and author. Watch for his work. Jack Beatty, last word goes to you here.
I'm not going to make any smart remarks about God. God be with the United States. How about that?
And God be with you, too. Jack, thanks for
Thank
being
you,
with
sir.
Us tonight. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.